CliffCentral.com.
That ended very suddenly. 7 o'clock. It's 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. It is time for a little Democracy 101, which is brought to you by the podcast party. Jack Motlanthe is my co-host this morning, and we are joined by none other than Granville Abrams, who is the general manager for electoral operations at the IEC. We've got lots to talk to him about this morning. We've got lots of questions from the audience. We'll take even more. If you want to drop yours into the comments section, we will make sure that Granville gets them, and he can probably answer all of them, although we're not going to put any pressure on you. I mean, you can't just pull statistics out of the sky. We're not going to expect you to know the answer to everything, Granville, you'll be pleased to know. But we have no doubt, considering the people we've already met who've been at the IEC and who have come to speak to us, I mean, it's a very well-run operation. And I got to tell you, no one's asked me to do this. No one's paid me to do this. But I am feeling full of confidence after meeting the people that we have met on this show from the IEC that we're going to have not only free and fair elections, but that they're going to run nice and smoothly. So I'm excited about that. And welcome to the studio. It's your first time with us. How are you, Granville?
Excellent. Thanks a lot for the opportunity, Gareth. And yeah, as you've mentioned, my first time. And hopefully I can be of some assistance and share some knowledge with the listeners.
Absolutely. Well, we've got a couple of questions here, but I'll let Jack start off, because now that registrations are closed, we can start looking at what actually is going to happen on election day. So for you guys, there's a lot of logistical stuff. You know, how many election ballot centers they're going to be, how many staff you guys have, what kinds of logistics can you bring to bear for the election. We've also got a date, which the last time we spoke to the IEC, we didn't have a date for the election. So we know it's the end of May, 29th of May. So does this help you guys? Because you were waiting for a couple of things to be announced, the date, the registrations to close. So you can now kick into high gear on all of that stuff, right?
That's absolutely correct. We obviously plan to be ready, but in order to finalize and fine-tune dates, it's important that we have a proclamation. And once we had this proclamation, in terms of the legislation, we were required to do an election timetable. Now, the important thing about the election timetable is that it sets timeframes for contestants, political parties, and independents for this election. And it also sets timeframes for voters, which are very important. So we're glad that that has now happened and that there is surety. People know when the date is. We've also now published the timetable. So, you know, whatever impacts political parties or alternatively voters, we are now able to share that information with them.
Jack, I know you got a couple of things you want to know.
Yeah. Granville, thank you so much for coming through. And I actually wanted to find out, like, once you have set out the timeline and the timetable, as you just mentioned, what would be some of the things that you need to get off your checklist between now and the actual day of elections?
Well, Jack, thanks for that question. Maybe just to move back a couple of steps. I think the important thing is that the IEC is charged with delivering free and fair elections. Now, I don't know if we've ever interrogated that to ask ourselves what is free and fair. I'm sure everyone has their own understanding of that. But in terms of generally accepted standards for free and fair elections, it's important that first and foremost, that there is a legislative framework, and that being the Electoral Act and the election timetable. In fact, also forms an integral part of that. The next thing you need to have is a credible voters' roll, so that those who are eligible to vote, that their names appear, and those who are not, that their names are not on there. So that is where we find ourselves now. The first thing was, when the election was proclaimed by the president, effectively, in terms of the legislation, we said that is the cutoff date for registration. What we then did is we closed off all of our platforms, and we are now in the phase where we are cleaning out, and we've also expose the voters' roll for comments. So if there's any objections, that closed yesterday.
Okay.
The commission is now seized with entertaining those objections. And by next Monday, we'll have a final voters' roll, which will be certified. And that is the voters' roll that we will then take into this election.
Mm. So, Granville, sorry, what kinds of objections will people raise against the voters' roll? That's an interesting subject all on its own. I mean, you must get some pretty bizarre requests, but what are the usual run-of-the-mill things that people object to?
Well, first of all, exclusion. If Gareth Cliff registered and he now goes and inspect the voters' roll and he sees his name is not there, and then obviously he would have to take issue with that. He'd raise that matter with the commission and say, I applied. Here's all of my evidence and my proof. Why is my name not on there? Secondly, inclusion. You may be aggrieved to say, but this person, you know, that I see here on the voters' roll, I don't think that he should be here. Well, in this election, it doesn't really matter. But in local government elections, it's very, very applicable. For example, if you say this person, you know, does not belong in this ward or this address does not belong, that is not very relevant in this case. Then also maybe issue of citizenship. They may say, but I know this person, how did he obtain citizenship? As far as I know, he is not a South African, and why is he on the voters' roll? So basically those type of issues. And maybe even also the details. You may be on the voters' roll, but your details may be incorrect.
Okay. When you say, I mean, I can imagine a lot of people who would say, I don't want this person to be on the voters' roll. But in a local election, that's more likely to happen, you say, because, for example, they might have been registered in the wrong area and they don't actually live there, or they've got it wrong and they'll end up at the polling station. They won't be able to vote. So that kind of thing. What about dead people? I mean, what if you discover someone like your grandmother? Because you guys can't know everything. You don't know everything, right? So you can't put in all the information and remove names of dead people. And sometimes there might be a couple of people who've been gone for like 5 years who are still on the list. So should people be reporting dead relatives?
Yes, no, absolutely. What we do, however, Gareth, is that we verify the voters' roll against the population register. Mm-hmm. And it may be, in the case as you've mentioned now, that administratively a death may not have been reported or recorded at Home Affairs, and it would still be, the person may still be listed as a valid citizen, alive and well. And because of that, when we run it against the population register, we will not pick that up. On the other hand also, we could also find someone that is listed as deceased, but is alive and kicking. And we've had cases like this in the past. Somebody would come to vote. And we'd say, well, I see your name here, but on the voters' roll, you're at the segment of rejected voters, and it has you listed as deceased. Now, I think that in a case like that, we are only reporting what Home Affairs has verified for us. And I think that you have probably bigger problems than voting on the day, because if you're listed as deceased, by on the population register, you basically don't exist as a citizen. I'm sure that you won't have a bank account, you won't be able to enroll at university, and a whole lot of other things. So it is a way also of alerting citizens. And what we then advise them is that you need to get hold of Home Affairs immediately so that you can resolve that with them. But unfortunately, that is what we have to verify against. And if the person is listed either as alive and deceased, or deceased and alive, that is what we would record on the voters roll.
As the general manager for electoral operations, I imagine that you are in charge of a lot of many moving parts to make this free and fair election happen. Are there any kind of safeguards that you have? Because, I mean, when I think about the election that took place in 2016 and 2020 in the US, where it was said that the election was stolen and all of this stuff, what kind of safeguards do you have to kind of get rid of those kind of narratives ever popping up?
You know, that's a very important question, and I think it needs to form an integral part of our voter education, because everybody has their own perceptions.
Yeah.
But here are the facts. And I'm not only saying this because I am the general manager for electoral matters at the IEC, but consider the following. South Africa, first and foremost, I think has the most transparent electoral system. And in doing that, consider the following. First and foremost, the entire legislative framework, the legal process, it is transparent. Even citizens have an opportunity, as we've seen now with the Electoral Amendment Act, to participate in the legal process, making laws. Political parties, definitely. And then when we plan elections, as you've seen now, first of all, with the election timetable, we didn't just publish. We are required by law to consult with the political parties, which we did. Mm. When we do our voting stations and our voting districts, we are also required to consult, and political parties actually physically have to sign off on all of these things. When we recruit staff, and I know staffing is a very contentious issue, we actually give the names to political parties at a local level, and we ask them to provide reasons why people should not be appointed. To voting day, we allow political parties, party agents, we allow observers to be a part of the process. If they are not happy, they may object. If they are not happy with the objection not being entertained, they may object to the, if the results are, the objection is material to the outcome, they may submit that to the commission. If they're not happy with the commission, they may go to the electoral court, which is a focus court. When it comes to counting, we count immediately afterwards, and we have a paper system so everybody can see what's happened. It's not electronic so that you can't see what's be happening there. Parties are part of that. They are, once the result, everything is counted, after they've been there for the whole day, they can take a photographic image of the result slip. Mm-hmm. The results are audited by external auditors, independent auditors. Once that is done, we provide them a platform where they can access our results system and see the actual captured form. They can capture that with their photographic image. And we even give them access, API access to the results, so they can do their own analysis and run their own back-end processes. And as I said at the end of the day, if anybody is still not happy, there's either appeal to the commission, or alternatively, there's the electoral court. So that, for me, is the most transparent. Now, when we have some observers that come here and they observe our elections, and then they say, your process is not transparent. I'm specifically talking about our observer brothers and sisters from the continent. They say, but your process is not transparent. And then we ask them, what do you mean? They say, no, your ballot box is not translucent. I can't see through it. So transparency has different meanings, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, that was a bit lengthy, but
I actually love the fact that you went into detail, because what it does is it dispels the notion that our election is somewhat like the state at some point, that it's captured. It's not. And it also helps with letting some of us know exactly where to go to find the answers that we might be looking for. You know, a friend of mine continuously points out the fact, to me, at least in some of our conversations, that companies like SAB can get to places where ballot boxes cannot. In as far as voting stations are concerned, are we going to see more of them? Is the IEC doing anything to make them more accessible to perhaps people in rural areas and that kind of thing?
Yes. And specifically when we get to local government elections, we will have to do a review. Ahead of every election, we do a review. We call it a re-delimitation exercise, and the keyword is limiting. We want to contain the and keep the number of voters per voting district or voting station manageable. So we do this re-delimitation exercise ahead of each and every election. Obviously, for this election, we have to contain ourselves within a ward because we can't go across wards. When local government election comes on board, where wards are re-demarcated, then we'll have an opportunity to play around with that as well. In terms of international standards, last time I looked, I think that we are hovering just around 1,000 voters per stream. We currently have about 23,000 odd voting stations. Mm-hmm. But some of those voting stations have additional streams, so there's about 30,000 streams. Now, if we compare to 1994, when we had these long snaking queues,
yes,
we had 13,000 voting stations. Now, this re-delimitation process is done in consultation with political parties. And specifically, you mentioned now rural areas. I think our colleagues in the, if I want to call it rural provinces, they have done significant work. I know in Limpopo and in Eastern Cape, either two or three elections ago, they went through a massive exercise, you know, in terms of being able to reach out and make voting more accessible. But you'll find that the bigger challenges are more in your urban areas where you have growth is quite fast. And even though it may be voting stations, may be in close proximity, there's also the issue about manageability. You don't want to have 20,000 people that's coming to vote at the school.
Yeah, so can I just ask quickly, you know, Granville, for many of us, you will wait a little while, but it's not, I certainly, the longest I waited was, I think, 2 hours at mine. But what is your smallest and what is your biggest voting station?
Yeah, smallest, we could have less than 100, about 50 people. But that would be in very, very remote areas that you have. And then our biggest station, I think it's somewhere here in Johannesburg, where we have close to 20,000 people. But now that station is a bit of a conundrum. Yes, we have a lot of people, but the number may not be, you know, in terms of voters that will actually pitch up. Because from what I understand, I think it's Joubert Park, where you have a lot of transit, if you want to call it transit voters, coming through there. So you'll find probably that voters don't go and re-register once they have sort of settled. For this election, however, our biggest voting station is not going to be in South Africa. Get it? It's going to be in London, by all accounts. Currently, we have just under 20,000 citizens on the voters roll. And then we still have the process where South Africans inside the borders and maybe even anywhere else in the world will have the opportunity, should they be in London, to say, I want to cast my vote in London. We call that the VEC10 process. So that number could even increase and can get much bigger.
All right, well, I didn't know that London would be our biggest. And, you know, there are often questions from people about which polling stations, you know, they can use overseas. We actually covered that, I think, quite well the last time we had the IEC on. But just to be clear, all the votes, all the international votes put together is not enough to get even one seat in Parliament, as I understood from the guys who were in last time. Is that still the case? Oh, by the way, how many... I'm asking you two questions at once here. Sorry. How many registrations did we have at the end? What was the final tally of total registered people?
Is this now for international or on the entire voters
front? Total, yeah.
Yes. We are still, obviously, Gareth, when the voters roll closed,
yes,
we had 27, close to 27.8, just under 27.8. Now, the reason why I say it's not final as yet, because remember, we now gone through the maintenance and objection process, and we need to certify on Monday. We'll have the final number on Monday, but it's around 27.7 million, which, if I may add, is the highest that the voters' roll has been since we have started. We still have a gap, but this is the highest figure ever. And so much so for the prophets of doom that talk about a democratic recession. This is the first indication, you know, that democracy is alive and well. And we also expect that for this election that we will have a very good turnout.
Excellent. Well, that's good news, and that's worthy of celebration. I think people should be very proud of the fact that so many more people have registered and that they will go and hopefully vote. No good to just register if you're not going to vote. So what do we do with special voting? Because there may be people who are out of the country that day. There may be people who are not in their neighborhood. There are people who have got to work that day, you know, if you're in emergency services or whatever. What do those people do? And also old people who maybe can't make it to the poll, don't want to stand in the queue. What are the different exceptions that you guys will allow for early or special voting?
Thanks. I think that's very important for voters. This is key information. The first category, Gareth, is you now know what the election date is.
Yes.
It is the 29th of May. Mm-hmm. So if you know for a fact that on the 29th of May, you are not going to be at home, and home being the place where you registered. Let's say, for example, Gareth is registered in Sandton. But on the 29th of May, he knows that he has a meeting in Cape Town.
Right.
And he's going to start traveling maybe the Friday already because he wants to make a weekend of it. So he's not going to be around here. So he's going to be outside of his voting district. For this election, same as in local government election, you can only vote where you are registered. The exception is, however, is that you may notify the chief electoral officer. And this will be as from Tuesday onwards. You will be able to notify the chief electoral officer and tell him, I want to go and vote in Cape Town because I'm not going to be here. But by saying that you want to go to Cape Town, you actually also need to nominate the station where you're going to be. So now Gareth knows that he's going to be in Sea Point. And he says, the voting station there that I identify with is Sea Point Town Hall. We will have on our website a facility whereby you are able to then do that notification. So what this will allow the IEC is to notify that station to say, expect Gareth to come to Sea Point Town Hall and you will be on a list there. You will then be able to cast your vote there.
Okay.
The maybe at this stage, if I may also mention, the fact that you're going to be outside of your province will mean that you will only be receiving one ballot. That is the national compensatory list ballot. You will not receive a provincial ballot for Gauteng, since you're registered in Gauteng, nor will you receive a provincial ballot for Western Cape because you're not registered there. And at the same time, also the regional list ballot. So you only get the one ballot.
Okay.
If however, you remained in Gauteng, somewhere in Gauteng, you would then still get all three ballots if it was a station here. So that is for people that's going to be away from their voting station. Okay. Now, the second category is people who say, oh, on the 29th, I am not going to be here, or I'm going to be working whole day, but I'll be available on the 27th and 28th. Those people may apply for a special vote, once again through our website, special vote, and they will say, I'm coming to vote at the voting station where I'm registered, not on the 29th, but on a special voting day. And you will then be expected, and you'll be on the list, and you can cast your vote there at the voting station where you are registered, but a day or two before.
Okay. The third
category is for the gogo who is at home in a wheelchair. She's bedridden, or for some or other reason, as a result of her condition, is unable to go to the voting station. That person may apply for a home visit. Now, it's very important to note that in the case of a home visit, we can visit you anywhere. It does not have to be in the voting district where you are registered. So if Gogo is visiting Jack, and Gogo is maybe from the village, but now she's visiting Jack, she can then apply for a home visit at Jack's residence.
Right.
Once again, if that address is outside of a province, she'll only get a single ballot. But if that address is inside, she'll get all ballots. So that's basically the three categories.
So I'm a bit of a skeptic, and I enjoy questioning everything. When it comes to the counting of the ballots, we are not using the electoral process. So do those boxes get immediately opened at the voting station and counted there, or are they transported to a different venue where the counting will begin?
Okay. First and foremost to note is that special votes are a day or two prior to the big voting day.
Okay.
So what happens is that we allow party agents to witness the entire process, to follow our teams. So we will notify party agents, the teams that will be going out, and they can then accompany. The ballots are follow what we call the double envelope system. So the voter will be provided with ballots, be given two envelopes. What we call the smaller envelope is unmarked, and voter will place the ballots in that. Then that envelope will be placed in a bigger envelope, which is the marked envelope. The person's ID number is then written on there, and name, etc., details. So that when we get back to the voting station, first of all, there's a pre-approved list of home visits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you must be on the list in order to receive a home visit. Anyway, once the task is completed, they will go back to the voting station. We call that the office of the presiding officer. Mm-hmm. There, a reconciliation will take place to mark off those ID numbers that can be evidenced from the outer envelope off the list to say, yeah, these people, they're valid people, and etc. And then on voting day, you'll find that we'll open up the outer envelope and we'll then place it with the rest of the ballots.
Mm-hmm.
So that when it comes to counting, we open up the unmarked envelope and then count the ballots together.
I was just going to ask, so that you're not revealing who the person who you did the home voting is voting for, because they would be worried about not being identified with their name on the outer envelope and their vote on the inside. What if they don't want anyone to know who they voted for?
The secrecy is maintained by the double envelope system, because remember, the outer envelope is disposed of during voting day, and the envelopes are then mixed with all of the other ballots. So when it comes to counting, you have blank envelopes. There's no names on there. The identity has been discarded. And that has now been thrown away after we've reconciled the entire process. So when you open up these envelopes, you get ballots there. Those ballots are not linked to any specific person.
Okay, perfect. What about special votes in terms of people who, I don't know, maybe they just they can't wait in the queue. They've got an emergency that they have to deal with. Do they just have to forfeit their vote on that day? Let's say someone, the kid at home, trips and falls, and you have to rush him to hospital, and now you don't get a chance to vote. Too bad, right? IEC can't be responsible for everything.
I think that, Gareth, this is why, you know, when we recruit presiding officers, we're asking for people that are able to manage and mediate and to be able to respond to unique circumstances. So, for example, what we do train our people is to say that, you know, you need to identify people in need. So if you, for example, see that there is an elderly person standing in the queue and it's a long queue, then they are trained to go to that person and say, ma'am, can you please move this way? I want to attend to you first. And they'll explain to the other people in the queue. I'm sure that everybody will want to, get out of the queue as fast as possible. And would probably say, I need to be attended to first. But our presiding officers are not unreasonable. And mm-hmm. if they are approached, they will deal with the situations as they come across them.
Now, this year, I don't know if it's the first time ever, but a lot of voter registration was done online. A lot of people use their phones for a multitude of things. How close or far are we from having remote voting where I can verify my identification on the phone or on the tablet or on my laptop or whatever the case may be, and I don't have to necessarily stand in line to cast my ballot? How far into the future is that from becoming a reality?
Yeah, no, thanks. You know, the whole e-voting thing is not something that the IEC is running away from. In fact, we actually started the whole debate, I think about 11 years ago in this country. We have also done some research. We actually went so far as in, 2021, or it was now with the amendments that we had proposed for this election, but I think it was 2021. Mm-hmm. We introduced a clause with the intent of trialing, going on trial with electronic voting in whatever form, and we put in a clause in a proposal which we invited comment in, and we said we would like to experiment with other forms of voting, and it was misinterpreted, and there was lots of negative comment about that from certain NGOs, so mm-hmm. much so that we abandoned that thought. But suffice to say, it is not a unilateral decision that the IEC can make. First of all, it is would require legislation. So as far as that is concerned, we would need to obviously get political parties, parliament, etc., on our side. It would probably, depending on how you want to go, you know, if you're going to go electronic machines or counting machines, it will require an investment. So Treasury would probably also have to be on board. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it's not a unilateral decision. But I think what you can be rest assured as a South African is that you have a world-class election management body. We have embraced digital transformation. The only thing that is still paper-based, it's just the ballot mm-hmm. and the counting process. But in every other aspect, we have gone digital. If I look, for example, at candidate nomination system that we have is the only system in the entire world where we tell a political party, there's a platform, go and nominate your candidates. You can pay on there and everything and verify your candidates and complete the entire job without sending in any paper to the IEC. Nowhere else in the world do you have that. So we've really embraced that. But when it comes to remote voting or even electronic voting, we have machines. That is a conversation that we obviously want to be a part of, but it's not a unilateral decision.
Sure.
Granville, can I ask about the ballot papers that are not used? So you'll obviously have a bunch of ballot papers afterwards, and people worry from a security point of view, what happens to those ballot papers that aren't used at the ballot stations? Are they put in a box and sealed and destroyed, or what happens to them?
Yes, I think that's very important, Gareth. First of all, we plan for 100% turnout. I think it's suicidal to plan for anything less. I think there was one year I can remember in Italy a few years ago. The election management body there or the authorities decided that they're going to plan for less than 100%. I don't know, because of the fact that participation was not as high. I think they planned for 50 or 60%. And then they ran out of ballot papers and they had to extend voting so that they could print some more ballot papers. Now, we plan for 100%. For this election, for example, we're probably going to be printing, I think the figure I heard from the other day was about 90 million ballot papers. Wow. Now, you may ask, why are you printing 90 million ballot papers? Well, first of all, there's three ballot papers per voting station. Each voting station will have three. It will be the national, it will be the regional, and then also provincial. So if you divide that by three, you get to about 30. And now you want to ask, why 30? Because I just told you I've got just under 28 million.
Right.
The 30 million comes in to the fact that I print these things in books of 100. That is how it gets rounded off. And with all of those rounding, you find that at the end of the day, those numbers go into that. So that's a sort of a thumb suck, but about 90 million. Now, what happens to the unused ballot papers? First of all of the ballots are at the voting station so that we don't run out of ballots. A ballot paper reconciliation is done at the end of the day, before counting. Even at the beginning of the day, in the presence of party agents, they will say, yes, all the ballots that we receive, so many books equates to so many ballots. At the end of the day, we do a reconciliation. We say we've issued so many, or at least we have so many left. We receive so many, so the difference must be issued, less cancelled, etc. So that when we count, we get to that amount. All of the ballots go back in the ballot box, whether it is now used or unused. 6 months after the elections, that's the earliest. The commission may then, at that point, they may then issue instruction that it may now be disposed of. We send a lot of this, all of the paper, but specifically this ballot goes back for pulping. So that it goes back into the cycle for recycling, and in that way we also make our contribution towards recycling and those things.
A lot of paper.
It's a lot of paper. It's a lot of paper. Have I ever seen bigger paper exercises than this? We assisted one year with the DRC printing of their ballot papers. The printing companies, presses, didn't have enough spaces for the reams, the rolls. We had to have warehouses just to store the rolls. We had to then transport them, get them back to the warehouse in the form of a ballot paper. And after we printed all of the ballot papers, then there's some people that were in the bush in the DRC that decided they now want to also come to the table. And all of those ballot papers had to be pulped again and started anew. So it's a lot of paper.
Yeah.
In fact, the exercise is so much so that ahead of an election, it is not unusual for us to have discussions with the printing industry just to establish if there will be enough paper in the country. So it's not just you wake up one day and say, I want ballot papers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd like to go back to the online conversation. Social media plays a very large part in our daily lives. And, you know, sometimes to the good, sometimes to the bad. So there's going to be, I imagine, a lot of misinformation and disinformation on the day of the elections. I remember a couple of years, there were pictures circulating around of ballot boxes that were thrown on the side of the road, and it turned out not to be the truth. Are you guys prepared in as far as the influence of social media might have on the day of elections in terms of misinformation and disinformation?
I think the challenge there, Jack, is that it doesn't matter how prepared we are.
Mm-hmm.
With social media, you can post something now, you can have it reported or monitored and taken off. But once it has been flighted, the damage has already been done.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we require and invest in is in terms of educating voters and citizens out there that it's election season now, you know, and these things are going to happen. And whatever you see happening, you need to question. So, for example, we're going to see some of the pictures that have that we've seen for the last 2-3 elections, and it's going to appear as if it's now current things.
Mm.
Secondly, what you see is not really what it projects to be. Just to give you an example, typical example, let's say ballot boxes that ended up on the field. Now, what is a ballot box? Was it the ballot box with ballot papers in, or is it just a box? So the one example that I'm referring to is we employ people on the day, ward managers, they have their bucky or whatever, put stuff at the back, and it's flat-pack cardboard furniture, whether the ballot box, a chair or a table. You've seen these things.
Mm-hmm.
So they're
mm-hmm.
all flat-pack. So you put it on the bucky, you drive down the Ben Skuman or whatever, and it flies off because you didn't secure it. Now somebody comes there, he sees this flat-pack, and he takes photos of it and says, oh, ballot boxes are laying in the field. The election hasn't started.
Mm-hmm.
it is something it's something that obviously that we don't want to see happening.
Of course.
But now there's a story behind this. Let me give you another one, for example. As I've mentioned to you, the process, after the votes have been counted, they are then reduced to a result slip that parties have make an image of. Everything else is put in the ballot box that is sealed and has to go to a warehouse. Now, that ballot box filled with ballots and they marked, and most importantly, they've been counted and they've been recorded. That ballot box is compromised after the results has already been recorded. The storyline will be, this marked ballot box. The ballot box was found with marked ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how the election has been compromised and all of that. Once again, it is not something that I want to find excuses for. We don't want those things, but you need to look at context. So it's going to be a tough ask at the end of the day, because case in point, I don't know if you're aware of this, 2 or 3 days ago on social media, somebody said, they've seen the ballot paper for this election.
Okay.
And a certain party has been included.
Mm.
The candidate nomination is only closing on Friday.
So how can we have it? It couldn't have been possible, yeah.
But because of the fact that, you know, I think the only way to prohibit this or to counter this is through education. Because I don't think really that there's been a mechanism to stop it timeously.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult waters to sail through. That is pretty straightforward. I think what I was trying to figure out was whether or not there would be someone from the IEC who'd kind of be overlooking to take note of any trends that might pop up during the day. As difficult as it might be to, you know, offset anything that happens on social media. I think what you're pointing to is that by educating people, we'll be in a position to make much better decisions in as far as what's happening on social media. Yeah.
Yeah, we do have a partnership with Real 411 that monitors this. We've also had a workshop with political parties on with Real 411 as well as your social media giants, just to educate them on the rules and you know, the protocols to follow if there's any complaints and etc. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the rank and file out there is those who want to be mischievous. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, whether or not they're acting in the interest of anyone, whoever they purportedly acting on, those people will disown them. So at the end of the day, we're looking at individuals. And it's very difficult to track them on social media.
Definitely, yeah.
It's extremely difficult.
No, it is. And there's another question here from Slippery Pickle, which I think is quite interesting, because people are always concerned about foreign interference in our elections, right? And Slippery Pickle says here, when NGOs challenge the IEC, do they actually do an investigation of the NGO? Because the NGO could be foreign funded, which could in some way be tantamount to foreign interference. I mean, do we just take complaints from everyone, objections? When they challenge you on some specific thing, do we just take everybody's complaints or some people ignored because they're foreign funded and don't actually have any business being involved here?
Yeah, no. Well, we treat every objection or complaint in good faith. But I think the question that you're raising, Gareth, is that we've now got political parties to account, you know, in terms of their funding. But NGOs, not that I want to be critical of them, but in terms of the issue that you're raising now, there is no requirement for NGOs to disclose their funding. So I don't know. You know, there's probably a gray area.
All right. And then I mean, this is another good question. Is there a tender process for all these, this printing of these ballot papers? I mean, how does that all work?
Yes. We are a public funded institution. And as such, we are subject to the Public Finance and Management Act. And that means that we have to comply with all the procurement procedures. And it's a good question that is being asked now, because there's a lot of procurement that goes into electoral logistics. And one of the things that we have achieved this year that was a bit of a difficulty in the last election is that we were able to complete and advance on our procurement processes, with most of them having been achieved last year. Even the ballot papers, be assured we haven't printed them, but we do have the service providers, the panel of service providers. We have gone through those processes. We have them on board. Now, basically what this means is that I think everything over 500,000, that estimated over a value of 500,000, you need to go out in a public tender process. Anything below that, you can get three quotations, competitive bidding for that. The tender process must be public, must be advertised. We also have our website where we have what we call an e-procurement system, where all of our tenders, the specs, the award, and all of those things can be viewed. And as I said, also as a public institution, anybody that's interested in any of these processes or to see who bidders and stuff was, these are public documents.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Very good. Are there any unique challenges you're expecting from this year's election, apart from the number of people who's, you know, it's more than they've ever been in terms of registered voters? Are there any other things that you guys have had to look out for? It's impossible to plot and plan everything, but you've got to have, you know, a huge amount of foresight, and you've got to be able to look almost into the future and be able to tell what's going on before the rest of us do. Are there any things that you're particularly worried about that you guys are paying attention to that we don't even think of when we think of what the IEC has to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot has been said that in this election, we're going to have three ballots. But, we normally have three ballots in local government election, with the exception of metros. So metros, where you have higher numbers, will for this first time in an election have three ballots. So we are obviously mindful of that. We hope for a high turnout, but a higher turnout, more traffic will also require that the process may also obviously be lengthened and extended. So that one we are monitoring closely. The other one is, but we'll have an indication by Friday in terms of the size or the length or the extent of the ballot paper. So what this could impact on, and we have made provision already in terms of certain of these aspects, is if your ballot is too big, will your ballot box not be too small? So obviously now you're going to have to get more ballots, those type of things. So it's basically just the entire process as it's impacted by a combination of turnout. We obviously always prepared for 100% turnout, but turnout with a bigger ballot, more choices, and that impacting and affecting the process. And the knock-on effect on that is, you know, people start getting edgy, if it takes a bit longer, etc. Now, maybe, I think what we've actually noticed in the past is that the tendency, South Africans are normally very late in responding, but on voting day, everybody is early. So by 11 o'clock, we would have probably have had 60-70% of people would have been voted already, which means all of them come early because they with the intention that they want to get done with it as quick as possible. I don't suggest that, you know, that it's possible to say to people come at phased intervals, and but then everybody comes late again or everybody comes in the afternoon. But this is just something that we need to deal with. And the appeal to people would be is that please do not be intimidated by early morning queues. The queues normally start before form, before we have started. So give us an opportunity to, you know, to show you that we can process this. So we need people that can think on their feet, ensure that the queues move.
People are keen.
Yes, the introduction of our voter management device will ever also assist in processing people quicker, because it will just require a scan of the ID number and we'll have all of your details there and you'll be able to move on with somebody else marking off your name. So we hope to see that also you know, aiding the process.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit here. In the unlikely event that the election has to be postponed or all out cancelled to another date, what kind of issues would have to prop up for that to happen? I imagine it's an unlikely scenario, but what would have to happen for the IEC to just say, you know what, we can't have these elections this year or maybe on the 29th of May?
Well, I think first and foremost, to answer the first part of your question, that one is beyond doubt. It's not for the IEC to say. The Constitutional Court has already ruled on the matter of elections must take place every 5 years.
Okay.
So that can't be postponed. And it's not for the IEC to postpone. Mm-hmm. There is provision in the legislation that the Commission may postpone voting at a specific voting station if there's been maybe, let's say, give an example, flooding, people couldn't get across the river and there no voting took place. In a case like that, the Commission can postpone voting to another day, but it's got to be obviously within the time frame for us to still be able to announce the results. I think it's 2 or 3 days. I think that if anything should occur that it's not possible to hold elections, I think that elections should probably be the least of our concerns because it will impact on a whole lot of other things.
Right.
Let's say, for example, a natural disaster. I think we'll have bigger things to worry about than elections. For example, if we should have what's the word they use? But if we should have a total power shutdown.
Yeah.
I've seen that these things can take up to 3-4 weeks to get the grid started again. We'll have bigger problems than just having to vote. So, yeah. So we'll have to deal with those issues when we arrive there.
So short of the grid collapsing, we are voting.
We are voting.
Okay, cool.
There are one or two quick questions I just want to throw in here because Jittery Cursor wants to know, how's the Western Cape's quota for regional seats calculated and determined? Do you know that answer offhand?
Yes. I think that, you know, when we look at this, the quotas, people may say, but KZN has more people than, or more populace than Western Cape, and but Western Cape's quota is higher. I think what we need to bear in mind, what is the quota? The quota is the quantum of seats that was required, the quantum of votes that was required to get a seat in that legislature. On that regional list. I think the question regarded regional. So
yes,
how regions. Do you, first of all, how do you calculate that quota? It is a factor of, on as a numerator, you say the number of people who voted. And as a denominator, it says how many seats are there in the legislature. It's just a simple proportional calculation. Now, the Western Cape has 42 seats, I think, in their legislature, in the provincial legislature. I'm now toggling between legislatures and regions again, but it's the same principle involved. Mm-hmm. Now, because of the fact that you only have 42 seats in the legislature for the province, but 80 in KZN, so it's almost double. So you can see that having an impact. And then also the voter turnout will have an impact. So it's not based on population. It's based on voter turnout. And then also the quota is arrived at by dividing it by the amount of seats. And in so doing, you'll find that Western Cape, in the case of provincial legislature, I think is higher than KZN. So that's how it's achieved. Yeah.
Okay, and then finally, someone wants to know here, the permanent marker they use on our nails, no whiteboard markers allowed. You guys obviously have to make sure you've got enough of those. How long does it last? What is the purpose of it? Just go through those marks. Are we going to get them this year on our thumbs?
Yes, you are most definitely going to get them. This is part of, this is embodied in the legislation as part of the voting process. And it is one of the measures to ensure that we are able to identify whether you have voted or not. The other one, obviously, is marking your name off the voter's roll. And then we also have a third measure, whereby we're able to identify this now. This is through our voter management device machines that are connected through an APN and through our service. So if you have cast a ballot at a voting station, we are able to pick it up should you present yourself at another voting station. We would be able to identify that. Now, the marking, the marking ink is, I don't know exactly how long, but it's probably as it will grow out and it will fade over time. But it is not something that is going to disappear immediately a day or two later. So bear with us if a lot of people have sacrificed a lot for our democracy. So the least we ask of you is just to have the little mark on your nail.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even painful. I mean, all things considered, it's just a tab of ink. Okay. Like
it is something that you should, Jack, it's something that you should wear with pride.
Yeah.
To say, you know, yeah, look, yeah, I've made my mark. It's my democracy. I owned it. Yeah.
And
I've
participate. Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely.
And I mean, unless you're a hand model who's got work that day, there's no reason for you to be particularly worried. All right. Listen, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground here, Granville, and I know that there's probably a whole lot more that you could have still told us, but I really appreciate you answering all of these questions. Thank you to everybody who posed questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to every one of them, but I think we've tried our best to get as many of these things dealt with as possible. If people still aren't sure of something, if they want to get hold of the IEC, I know that you guys are open to anyone from the public who has any concerns or questions. What is the best way for them to get hold of you?
There's different platforms, Gareth. First of all, there's our toll-free line. It's 0800 11 8000. So we have operators that can answer a host of questions. We also have a WhatsApp line, and well, that number you could find on our website. I don't know it often. Then if you just want to find out what your registration status is, you can do a SMS with your ID number, 32810. Our website also has relevant information, specifically those who are interested in the special vote, home visits, and the Section 24A. I think also most importantly is that look out for the dates. Very soon, we will also be publishing the list of candidates for political parties for inspection to invite comment. And then thereafter, we'll do final list. So I hope that voters, in considering their choices, will actually make use of this information to see who the candidates are before they just go in blindly. If all else fails, we also on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and we're also responding to questions there as well.
All right. I love it. Thank you so much. Very good to have you on this morning. Granville Abrams is the General Manager for Electoral Operations at the IEC, and we are gearing up. We're ready. It's only a couple of weeks away to the elections. Thank you so much,
Granville. We're 86 days away, actually.
86 days until you can cast your vote. Maybe an important election. We don't need to under or overemphasize that. I think people know. All right, Jack, from us, it's enough for this morning. We will see you tomorrow for this live interview that I recorded the other day. It's Daniel Taub, the expert in international war. I think you'll find him very, very interesting. That's tomorrow. And then we'll be back live on Thursday at 6 a.m. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.